I think human origins is really fascinating, especially at this moment in the 21st century, because there's still a lot we don't know, but there is a lot that we have sort of kind of started to fill in about our past.
Welcome to Learning from Experience, a podcast for college students and recent grads who want to hear directly from alumni on how they've adjusted their lives post-graduation, including stories of personal success, career readiness, and tips for navigating the real world. Created by the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Arizona State University. I'm your host, Megan Finnerty, and today I'm talking with Paige Madison. Welcome. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So you maybe don't know Paige, but Paige graduated from ASU in 2020 with a PhD from the School of Life Sciences and the Institute of Human Origins. Since then, she's wanted to do a postdoc over in Denmark. She's a science writer and editor. She's worked for places like PBS and National Geographic and just got her first book contract, which is a really big deal.
Yeah, thank you. That was a great summary of my last few years. Yeah, so I mean, I guess like the first place to start is that I love fossils. I've loved fossils since I was a little kid. And you know, somewhere in my regular university when I was getting my undergraduate degree, that became fixated on human fossils, human ancestors and close relatives, what we call hominins. So I became really interested in human evolution. And it turns out ASU is the best place to follow that passion. And so I started doing a master's and PhD combined at ASU in 2012 was when I kind of started, though I had kind of like a fit and start that first year, but I was fully in by 2013. And I did kind of an interdisciplinary degree where I was really involved with Institute of Human Origins and had one of my committee chair members was from there. His name was Bill Kimball, wonderful paleoanthropologist who studies the human past. And I had another foot in the School of Life Sciences in the Center for Biology and Society, as we call it, which gave me kind of my education there was a history of science perspective and a little bit of philosophy of science perspective. So I was kind of really interested in questions like how we have come to know what we know about the human past. Like when we find a fossil, how do we make sense of it? Like, what do we do with it? Like how does it kind of turn into this body of knowledge about our own sort of evolutionary history? So that's kind of how it all got started and unfolded for a few years.
Well, I just want to know everything from your love to fossils to your journey, professional trajectory. Where do you think we should start? Was it in your undergrad? Has it been since being at ASU?
The best place to start is in my undergrad. Two things had become clear. One was that I was really excited about science and how it works and how what kind of processes we use to understand anything. But again, it had been sort of trained on human origins. And it had become clear I was really interested in that. And it had also become clear that I did not want to shut up about it to anyone who would listen. And so hindsight could probably tell us quite well that that set me up pretty well to be what we call like a science communicator, in addition to being a scholar. I sort of explored these opportunities and I was encouraged to explore these opportunities to talk a little bit about what I was doing more publicly, whether that was giving public lectures or eventually writing a blog, which I was really resistant to at first, but worked out really well. And then ultimately that turned into writing magazine articles about human origins. And again, that sort of fit my interests and personality really well, because before I had like an internet audience or anything of this nature to sort of talk about fossils, my friends just had to hear about it all the time. So we'd be on a ski chairlift and they'd have to hear about the size of the Neanderthal brain and things like this. And so it's actually quite nice that I was able to find an outlet so I could give them a little bit of a break, not a full break, but a little bit of one.
Once you found that outlet and you were able to start writing about things that you're passionate about, what was that process like? I feel like I was somebody who was started off being trained as a writer. You started off being trained as a scientist.
Right. Yeah, it was quite piecemeal, actually. And I was just talking about this morning with a graduate student at ASU who's in the process right now. And I was just kind of wondering what it's like to have that writing background, because I never did. And so I sort of had to like pick it up from random places. Luckily, we did have, and we still do have, this wonderful program within the School of Life Sciences, within the Center for Biology and Society, that's called the Embryo Project. And that's run by one of my dissertation committee chairs, Jane Mineshine. It's basically this, you know, science communication platform, online platform, that a lot of us were kind of trained in. And fortunately, we are trained by professional journalists with a professional background. And, you know, we kind of got all of this writing and editing experience that was, it turned out, would be absolutely critical, because it did really form my only base for any kind of writing education. And then everything from there was basically picking up pieces from things I would read. I feel like I maybe could have moved a lot faster in the role if I had had more formal education, but it was great, because I got this, you know, sort of that more scholarly, science focused education, and then just kind of practice telling about it.
Well, and it goes way beyond practice. I mean, you've been in National Geographic. That is, when I think of science and I think of media, that's what I come to. What was it like for you to have your first piece? What was it?
Yeah, that was an exciting moment. And I should say that, like, that validated me, I think, to my family and those kinds of, you know, like, beyond anything else I'll ever do. Like, forget a PhD or anything, you know, that was the moment that I, you know, everybody sort of still talks about. And so hopefully I'll continue writing for them. But my first Nat Geo piece, and to this point, my only real Nat Geo piece, is, you know, one of those situations of being in the right place at the right time. I noticed something that was happening, that was about to happen in the scientific community, that I was lucky to sort of have some privileged access to, but I knew that a paper was about to drop, and I knew that it wasn't going to make the regular news cycle, because it was a paper about rat bones. But I also knew, because I worked really closely with the scientists, and this is a site that I work at for my dissertation research, and now for my book research, it's a cave site in Indonesia. And they were, some of the team members were about to publish a paper on these rat bones that had been found at this site. And again, on the surface, it was not necessarily, you know, a headline grabbing paper about a new human ancestor that was discovered. But actually, there were really important and interesting implications about a human ancestor that had been found at the site from the rat bones. And so I was able to pitch it to National Geographic, and it was a pretty wild experience, because, you know, those things happen very quickly, like much more quickly than any sort of academic timeline. And I was actually in Indonesia at the time. I was there on a Fulbright grant. And so we were working with like a 12-hour time difference, which I was pretty used to at that point, but I don't know if I'll ever be fully used to. And when you've got like a quick turnaround with National Geographic editors, it suddenly becomes more obvious that you are not on the same time zone. So I remember even being very strategic about sending them the pitch right when I thought their workday was going to start, around like 9 a.m., which was about 9 p.m. for me. And then sort of being up till midnight that night, because they immediately responded and said, "We'd love to do this. Yes, let's do it." And I think within 3 days, we had a whole piece done, edited, and then a few days later it came out with the scientific paper. And yeah, it was about this one analysis of, I can't remember how many rat bones, maybe 10,000 rat bones. So again, it wasn't even like,
a rat cemetery.
Don't get me started on how much I love this cave, because I could talk about it the whole time, but this is the main sort of site that I've been working at the last few years. It's an archaeology site, and they found a new species of human relative there back in 2004. And, it's a really interesting relative. We call it the Hobbit, because it was only about a meter tall. And it's just this really interesting, like, island story that we still don't quite have figured out in the science, which makes it kind of fun for me, because I kind of get to like talk about the process and how we're figuring it out. And so the cave where this one Hobbit species has been found is called Liangbua. And the team has been working at Liangbua for decades and decades. And there are tons of great sedimentary layers that go down 200,000 years and tell a really interesting story of human occupation, not only modern humans, which there are at that site, but then also hobbits. And so there's really interesting, like, human focused story. But actually, for those of us who work at the cave, to us, it's a rat cave, because 75% of the bones that come out of the cave are rat bones. And so, you know, the hominins, as we call them, are fairly impermanent in comparison to the rats. And so eventually, interestingly, the scientists tried to decide if there was a way to, like, learn from all of these rat bones. And they actually, by running really big analyses, they're able to trace, like, climactic shifts in the area based on which rats were in the cave at which times. And so again, like, not the sexiest paper in terms of, like, well, there wasn't one big finding. There wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, we found this new species of rat, although they have done that at that site as well. But it was like, we looked at an analysis of 10,000 rat bones. And so that got a paper in a National Geographic. And I should say also, it was one of the highlights of my career, not only because National Geographic is great, and that was really a fun experience, but also because the first author on that paper was a dear friend of mine who was actually a graduate student also at the time. She's now a postdoc at the Smithsonian. And to see her in National Geographic, I think, was almost more exciting than writing about it.
That just talks to the community that you have around you. Take me back. How do you go from being in a lab looking at fossils that are brought to you to being on assignments? It sounds like you probably travel all over the world to different sites.
Yeah. I think it definitely depends based on who you are and what your trajectory is and what kind of research questions you're asking. But I got really lucky when I was at ASU because I knew that I wanted to look at a handful of really important and controversial fossils from kind of the history of the field. Like, my research questions were around, you know, that question of how we know what we know about the past. And so I picked a couple fossils that I wanted to kind of really look hard at their story. My chairs of my committee and I sort of went back and forth for a while about which fossils would be, like, the most fun and the most interesting to do. And one of the things we, you know, decided was that getting the most global perspective possible would be fun and easy to sort of compare and contrast these different stories. So I ended up looking at a Neanderthal fossil from Europe that was found in the 1850s, and then looking at a South African fossil that had been found in the 1920s. So I spent a lot of time in South Africa, and then looking at this Indonesian fossil that was actually found in 2004. So very recently. And so kind of getting these, like, three snapshots of these different moments in science and comparing them. For me, a lot of what I was doing was storytelling of how these fossils got found, what sort of information was included in that discovery, and these types of things. One of the things that I realized quite early on is to tell really interesting stories about these fossils, being at the sites was really critical. And there's been a lot of really interesting research in how science is done that compares the lab and the field, because they couldn't be more different, but we need both of them. And so lab environments are very controlled, and you can control all these features so that you can get at, like, one variable or what have you. And in the field, it's often the case that you can't control anything. Like, even at some of the sites I've worked at, you can't even control really who wanders into the cave that you're in. And you just have to kind of, like, let go of that control, but then still do careful, you know, analysis. And so I sort of spent a lot of time observing how people are doing that and, like, what sort of methods they're using to do that, and spending a lot of time at those sites. And that's really informed a lot of the storytelling I do, and ultimately now the book that I'm writing. I got really lucky when I came to ASU and when we eventually landed on these fossils, because actually one of my committee chairs had a connection, especially with the Indonesia site, and that actually kind of got a foot in the door. So I got to go kind of directly there when I was doing dissertation research and, you know, really be part of the team for one of their field seasons. And then after that, I was pretty much just a goner because I loved it there and I knew I was going to sort of expand on that part of my research and probably spend more time there and more effort. And I did a Fulbright year there. I learned the Indonesian language. I spent a lot of time there. And it's the focus of my book now. So Indonesia has certainly suddenly taken a pretty central role for me.
Well, I called you a writer and a scientist earlier, but it also sounds like you're an investigator to really go back in to get those stories. So is your career trajectory typical of somebody who does the line of work that you're in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I should say, like, I'm extremely interdisciplinary. And so it's very hard to pin me down, I think, as far as a title. And I actually have come to love that. I think it used to make me really uncomfortable because my interest didn't quite fit in any box. But from the moment I got to ASU, actually ASU really embraces that for the most part. And that was certainly the case in my experience. Again, I started the program by having chairs in entirely different schools, like co-chairs of my committee. And they worked together beautifully. And really, the three of us, I think, were able to create a path for my career that did not look like any other path that anyone else had done, really. But it fit my energy and the things that excite me. And so that was really interesting. But it does make me hard to label. And it will always be a little bit challenging to be interdisciplinary. So, for example, I publish in journals across a few different fields. And so sometimes I publish in science journals, and other times I write papers for history of science journals, which is more of that investigative storytelling. And then sometimes I am a science writer and I'm writing for the public and, you know, a professional freelance science writer. And so I really have these different gears that I have to sort of shift into. But again, that works quite well for me. Occasionally people would be confused, like well-meaning people who would say, well, you're not really a journalist though, because you don't have a journalist background, or you're not really a scientist because your PhD is interdisciplinary. And I think that used to sort of hurt a little bit, but it turns out that's extremely freeing.
Where I'm excited for whatever book you're going to write, because it's probably going to be the most scientific book I've ever read that I feel like I can understand.
And that's the goal. The book I'm working on is a public-facing book. And so, you know, again, depending on what people know about my background or my history, sometimes they assume that this is an academic book, but it's absolutely not. It's a Simon & Schuster trade book. That the idea is supposed to be that human origins can actually be quite fascinating. And I'm on a mission, I always say, to make human ancestors sort of as culturally interesting as dinosaurs.
Well, you stole my question, because I was going to ask how you chose what you're going to talk about in your book. And so now I know your real mission. Could you give us just a slice? Like, what is it that's so fascinating about them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still working on this, to be honest, because I'm actually kind of at a little bit of a disadvantage because I like fossils so much. So like, you put a fossil skull or a photo of a fossil skull in front of me, and I'm like, that's beautiful. Like, that's gorgeous. Because that happens naturally, like, I actually have to work to be like, to try to convince somebody that doesn't have that natural instinct, which is definitely the norm, right? So I have to kind of backtrack and be like, okay, why am I processing that? And how can I like communicate it? I think human origins is really fascinating, especially at this moment in the 21st century, because there's still a lot we don't know, but there is a lot that we have sort of kind of started to fill in about our past. So we've got these really big personal questions about how we came to be who we are, what makes us human, those kinds of questions that I think a lot of us are interested in, and we're getting closer to the answers. But I'm not sure we're totally there yet, which I think is a really fun moment, because it allows us to kind of evaluate the different ideas and ask ourselves, you know, why these ideas have come about and, you know, what we think and what we value and that kind of thing. And so, you know, we've come to a point in human evolution as a science where we can understand basic things. I mean, we've got a beautiful fossil record now, much more than 50 years ago, even, that have kind of filled in these larger sort of chapter beats of how we've evolved to become human. So we stood upright on two legs, much later, we got this, you know, big brain, all of those sort of like general chapters, but we don't really know why yet. Like, why did we stand up on two legs? And how does, like, why do we have such a big brain? I mean, it seems obvious to us now because it seems that having a big brain is quite handy. But if you ask that in an evolutionary sense, big brains are actually also really expensive. It's where a lot of the calories that we go end up getting burned, because we've got to keep this thing running all the time. And it's kind of, there's some evolutionary trade-offs that have to happen that we end up kind of seeing in the fossil record a little bit, we think, but we still don't really know what kind of triggered that.
Okay, I just have to ask it. Do conspiracy theories impact your work?
I get asked all the time about conspiracy theories. And in fact, aliens is the most common one. You know, every now and then I'll give a public lecture and I'll be confronted by someone who, they tell me that they believe that aliens planted the fossils, which is really interesting. I mean, but, you know, I think what we always come back to, which is kind of a cop-out, but it makes my life so much simpler, is that whenever I get confronted with that, or even if I'm thinking about it in my own head, I'm like, what's possible? You know, really for me, the answer is we love evidence. As scientists, we're just sort of like focused on what we can look at, what we can test, what we can sort of run up against other theories and try to better understand. And while all of the speculations are, you know, kind of fascinating, it is just such a different realm, because it's, you know, like I would totally be down to hear about aliens dropping off fossils or what have you, if you showed me any proof. But a lot of this, you know, there's not a lot of evidence behind this. And it certainly doesn't mean things aren't possible, but it means that, like, the scientists, we tend to engage less with them, partially because we have so much to engage with anyway. So we'll kind of stay in that for now. But, you know, same with Bigfoot. I get asked about Bigfoot all the time, but there's never been any solid evidence for it. So until there is, you know, I'm going to operate in a world where I'm skeptical.
We have talked about conspiracy theories. We have talked about how we know what are related to humans. We have talked about storytelling, journalism, rats, being in caves, the education value at Arizona State University, and all while trying to define who you are, Paige, and what you do for work. And this has just been so much fun for me. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. That is quite the summary, but it does sum up my life pretty well. So,
well, thank you so much for joining us today. If you loved Paige's story and you want to know more about her experience, you can connect with her on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is @FossilHistory. To hear more alumni advice, head to our episode page wherever you listen to podcasts, check out the college's YouTube channel, or visit thecollege.asu.edu/LFE podcast.